Welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. I'm Ethan Zuckerman. I'm a fellow here, and you're here today for what promises to be a pretty interesting and provocative talk by Hal Roberts, who's sitting with me. Before we get started and start the wonderful ritual that the Berkman Center has of getting everyone to introduce themselves, I want to say hi to our webcast listeners and just remind everybody that you are under surveillance, which is the topic of the talk today. These talks are webcast to the whole world. They are blogged. There is nowhere to hide. If you wish to be off the record, you can say that to the bloggers in the room, but you're still going to be on the webcast. We are happy to have everyone here, both physically and virtually. And the way that we generally start these things is by going around in a circle, having everyone introduce themselves, and then we introduce the speaker, and then we hand it over. So,
I'm Harry Lewis. I'm a computer science professor here at Harvard.
I'm Steve Schultz. I'm a fellow here at the Berkman Center.
I'm Roxana Myram. I'm a research assistant at the Berkman Center.
Von Tan, a graduate student at Harvard.
Robert Farris, I'm the research director at the center.
David Ardia, I'm a fellow.
I'm Melissa Ledke, I'm with the Nieman Foundation.
I'm Persephone Miel, I've been here at the center with the Media Republic Project for the past year.
Darius Adamski, Fulbright Fellow.
David Larchelle, Berkman staff.
I'm Tim Horrigan, I'm actually wear several hats. I'm a writer and IT consultant. I'm also a member of New Hampshire's part-time citizen legislature. I'm actually introducing a bill about open source software in ballot counting machines. And
right. Gene Koo, Berkman Fellow.
Jonathan Powell, not fellow at MIT.
Mark Dion, independent software developer.
Kevin Moore, computer science department.
Laura Kornfeld, research associate at Harvard Business School.
John Dacon at the Business School.
John Merritt at the Kennedy School.
Benjamin John, graduate student, also intern with the Stop Backlog Project.
I'm Arasha, Berkman staff.
Daniel Jamous, intern at the Berkman Center.
Chris Babbitt, clinical fellow at Berkman Center.
Sebastian Diaz, chief geek at the Berkman Center.
Dan Colaspiro, member of the Geeks at the Berkman Center.
Mark Delty, once and future extension school student.
Brandon Cashy, I own and operate a small webcasting company called Latitude.
Andrew Drain, I'm a freelance web developer and consultant, also past and future Harvard Extension School student.
Robin Rosenberg, I'm a psychologist.
I'm a Coughlin student.
And he's Hal Roberts, who has been geek in residence for many, many years at the Berkman Center. Berkman sits at the interface between the internet, law, sociology, lots of other ways to study things. Lots of the things that we study have deep, complicated technical roots, and this is why we need deep, complicated technical people. Hal is one of those folks. We've had the pleasure of working together on a bunch of different projects. Hal's interests are really all over the map, lately have had a lot to do with surveillance, which turns out to be one of those extremely difficult things to study because if it's done well, you don't know that it's going on. And so Hal is going to talk today about our benevolent, or maybe not that benevolent, overlord, Google, which he argues is involved with an absolutely enormous percent of what we do online, which is something that perhaps we should be more worried about than some of us generally are. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to my friend and colleague, and go sit down and blog.
So this picture up here is what I found in the Hark yesterday when I was writing up this presentation. So I figured I had to take a picture of that and somehow include it. So I, you know, got out my cell phone and I'm trying to get a picture of this. And you can see it's a really horrible picture. There's some fluorescent light on top there, so you can't see the sign. So I'm, you know, fiddling with my cell phone, trying to figure out how to change the brightness setting on the horrible little phone. And I noticed some guy sort of walking past me with a power strip. Take a couple more pictures, it's not working. And I turn to the guy and he goes, "Can I help you?" I said, "Oh, I'm just, you know, I've got to talk, surveillance, I'm just trying to get a picture." He goes, "Okay." Gives me a good long look and then walks off. So that's our introduction to surveillance at Harvard.
So it's all caught on camera.
Yes, I should have taken a picture of him, but then I might have not have been able to come to the news. So, Google. Google owns two huge advertising systems. One is called DoubleClick, which is a big company they just bought. Another is called AdWords. DoubleClick and AdWords each account for about 35% of unique visitors to advertising websites. So that means not only does Google participate in serving its own pages, which are serve an enormous amount of traffic, but depending on what the number of advertised web pages are, it has access to information about 50% of all web traffic. There's something sort of troubling about that, right? At a minimum, they have information about which web pages you're viewing. So about half of all web pages that you view in general, Google knows about it. The problem is that Google doesn't do much with that data, and they don't have the power to do a whole lot with the data. There are lots of examples of surveillance. When you think about surveillance, you think about the NSA, or you think about Big Brother, or you think about your boss surveilling you. In all of those examples of surveillance, there are obvious obvious consequences. Your boss can fire you. The NSA can jail you or shoot you. Your insurance company can take away your insurance, right? So these are all sort of very important things. So the question for Google is, why do we care? Google can't shoot you. They can't fire you. They can't take away your health insurance. They can't do any of these things that we typically associate with surveillance power. But somehow it seems troubling anyway. So that's the question for today. Why do we care? One reason we could care is that Google can lose that data. We have huge numbers of data breaches every year. So we could care because someone might take all of Google's data. Okay. We could care because the government can get the data, right? So Viacom just got a list from Google of every video viewed on YouTube and who viewed it. That's kind of troubling, so we should care about that. But there still remains the question, even if let's assume that Google doesn't share the data with anybody, let's assume that you're not going to be taken away in the middle of the night by the NSA because of something you viewed in Google. Do we care then? Do we care if Google promises not to do anything, not to give the data to anybody? Do we still care? I think we do, and that's what we're going to talk about today. There are a lot of existing approaches to privacy and surveillance, but they all struggle with this question, and they all struggle because they all, at some level, are about individual harms, right? They're all about some actor surveilling someone and then doing something concrete to that individual. What I'm going to do first here is I'm going to walk through some examples of surveillance and privacy literature. I'm going to point out some ways in which they're not helpful, but I'm going to also point out some sort of elements that we can take from some of them that are helpful to start to answer this question. Some of these elements that help us move in the right direction are thinking about on the level of social discourse rather than thinking about single individuals. So what is the harm that we're doing to, or not necessarily a harm, what is the impact on society of watching rather than just the impact of a direct individual? Thinking beyond just one actor, thinking beyond just what is Google doing to me with the data, but who else is watching and what are they doing? And thinking beyond activities that we typically think of necessarily as surveillance. So thinking about other forms of watching and how they fit into that surveillance activity. The sort of stereotypical example of surveillance is the Big Brother 1984. You know, Big Brother watches you in the Ministry of Love, takes you in a room and interrogates you and makes you behave because of how they watched you. And this is when people sort of think about the NSA, you hear a lot about sort of Orwellian or Big Brother surveillance, and this is the sort of model we're thinking. It's actually Big Brother, even Big Brother itself is not that simple. There's another ministry in Big Brother called the Ministry of Truth, whose job it is to rewrite history, and they're arguably more important than the people who are going around torturing people. The tools used to surveil in Big Brother are these TVs that watch you, right? So you have this sort of interesting example of devices that both watch and are watched at the same time. And there's actually a pretty good case for, you know, community-based production in a networked public sphere, and that the people who are doing most of the snooping are your neighbors, right? So you have this sort of community production of snooping. It's not just one person who's watching you. But the lesson, nonetheless, that we take away from Big Brother is there's one big actor who's applying force onto a lot of individuals with the surveilled data. There are lots of examples in sort of history of, and currently of this kind of surveillance that have been studied and well. There are lots of examples of surveillance to enforce slavery, really brutal acts of violence, and very careful controls of slavery. There's the case of the NSA, the surveillance box that was found in an AT&T closet. This is an equipment list from an AT&T closet where I point out that NARIS STA 6400, which is just a powerful snooping device by a snooping company. There's the Yahoo, who was, you know, convinced by China to hand over information on a Yahoo Mail user in China, who was then arrested using that information. So there are lots of examples of on and offline surveillance where people are, in the real world, using the data to arrest people, jail them, lose their jobs, that sort of thing. Beyond simple exertions of force, we come to a guy named Foucault. Foucault's contribution was to explain how surveillance could exert force over society without necessarily resorting to direct violence. So his basic idea was, instead of, you know, executing people when they don't do what you say, we make people think that we're watching them all the time. And if you make someone think that they can be watched all the time from anybody, then they'll act as if they're being watched all the time. The sort of model for this was a panopticon, which is a kind of prison where the prisoners think they can be viewed at any time, but they don't know whether necessarily they're being viewed. And the idea is that they'll act as if they're being viewed all the time. And Foucault describes how in modern societies we use the same sort of techniques in institutions like factories and schools and hospitals. So in a school, we have all of these rules, these strict rules, so that we teach the children how to enforce the rules on themselves rather than making them us think that we're gonna, you know, execute them if they don't. There are lots of current studies of surveillance that sort of built up from this notion of social control. There's interesting work by a guy named Torrin Monaghan on CCTV cameras in the UK. There is extensive use of CCTV cameras. It's not clear at all that they're actually helpful, but it's also not clear that there's a good, that the frame between security and liberty is particularly helpful. There are other kinds of security, right? There's sort of social kinds of security that we should be concerned about rather than just, are you going to be blown up? But here again, you know, where we're interested in cases of security versus liberty, what you're talking about is the fact that the government might, you know, be arresting you because of something they've seen on a CCTV camera. Google's not going to arrest you, so it's not helpful in that sense. There are cases of, there are examples of scholarship on welfare surveillance. So we extensively control people who have welfare, for instance, to make sure they don't have a job and they're not married, right? That's very intrusive on people's lives, obviously, to make sure that they don't have jobs. And there's a lot of work by the welfare system to make sure that they don't understand where the data is coming from. So they're always sort of watching themselves. Again, that's not particularly helpful in the Google case because Google isn't taking away your check. There are a couple of examples of people who are looking explicitly at this consumer data problem. There's a guy named Gandhi who has this notion of social sorting, where he says that we use all of this data that the sort of vast data sphere uses this data that's collected to present people with different sorts of opportunities. So over your lifetime, if the data sphere determines that you should get mortgage offers, you're going to get mortgage offers, and that has an impact on over a lifetime whether people tend to get mortgage offers and they tend to be able to get mortgages. In this case, it's hard to sort of make a direct argument there that the reason we care about Google having all this data is that we might get more mortgage ads from Google, right? It's kind of true. It kind of makes sense, but the scope doesn't quite match up. The sheer amount of data that's being collected by Google doesn't quite match up there. A guy named David Lyon takes us further to talk about data doubles, and these where this sort of vast amount of personal data that's collected is actually used to make decisions about you. So it's not just that you might get more mortgage offers, it's that the credit agent, the banks know all of this data about you, and you might not get your mortgage because of all the data. again, you're not getting a mortgage from Google, and Google is not sharing or shouldn't be sharing the data, if we assume they're not sharing the data, so why do we care? Those are some surveillance approaches. On the privacy side, the sort of foundation of U.S. Privacy law was set by a law review article by Warren and Brandeis, and they set up this sort of right to be let alone. And what they were doing is they're responding to the problem of basically instant photography in mainstream media. They were concerned that all of a sudden it was very easy to take a picture of someone at a party and publish it in a newspaper, and it hadn't been possible to do that technologically before. And so how they responded to this was legalistically by saying, look, we're gonna set up a sort of right against publication, so any individual can protect his right against having his picture published in the newspaper, given certain constraints, which is a sort of narrow legal way of looking at the harm to the individual that can happen. But they also have this really interesting quote that I bypassed, where they talk, when in the beginning of the paper, when they're just sort of trying to form the problem, they talk in this sort of, you know, old language about sort of good discourse and bad discourse and sort of civilized discussion and non-civilized. But what they basically say is that gossip is bad, right? If we take gossip, which is what invasions of privacy can cause, if you take gossip and magnify it over a society, then you're going to get a society who talks about gossip instead of talking about things they should talk about. This provides a sort of interesting line for us to go down to start thinking about the effects that these things have on social discourse rather than just directly on an individual. What that, in the modern sense, what they're worried about is they're worried that we're going to get lots of gossip stories about Tonya Harding, right? And that sort of is more true. There's a guy named Rawson who has extended this, who's sort of updated this article, this Warren and Brandeis, to think a little bit more about context. And Rawson's point is that we need privacy because for social relationships to flourish, they need context. You need to learn someone over a lifetime so that any one individual fact doesn't dominate your perception of them. If you judge any of us by one individual fact, then it looks bad. And his example of this is Larry Lessig, who was the special master in the Microsoft case years ago, and it was widely published that he'd written one email that made him look very biased, and that's sort of how the world got to know Larry Lessig, and whereas Larry Lessig is obviously a more complicated person than that. So there's also a guy named Daniel Salove, who talks a little bit more about this notion of bureaucracy from a privacy point of view. And his point is that the problem is not so much that we're going to be caught by a big brother who's going to directly, you know, send us to jail and is going to be controlling us as some autonomous individual. The problem is that data ends up in these vast bureaucracies, right, where nobody really controls what happens. And that there's a book by Kafka called The Trial. This is about this guy who is given this letter that he's under, that he's been charged with a crime, but he can't find out what the crime's been, he can't find out what the status of his case is. He spends the whole time just trying to figure out what's happening to him, and at the end of the book, he's swiped away, and you know, all this. And so Salovey's worry is that the danger of having all this data is not so much that one big bad guy is going to do something really dangerous with it, it's that this sort of bureaucracy, unaccountable bureaucracy, is going to make decisions about our lives according to the data, and that is going to rule our lives without us understanding how or why. The problem here again is this poor guy is getting, you know, abducted in the middle of the night and stuck into jail, and it's not clear what power Google has to do that. Nope, I'm going the wrong way. So, what's helpful then? It's helpful to actually return back to Foucault for just a minute and look at a little bit closer at what Foucault was saying. One of Foucault's main points was not that the factory boss gains absolutely control over his workers by making them do what he wants them to do. He also makes the point that once you let anybody be a surveiller, then anybody gets to be a surveiller, and they have some control over that. And once you let everybody surveil himself or herself, then everybody gets to surveil herself. And there's a loss of control by the factory boss in making the worker surveil himself. And so what you end up with is this vastly more powerful machinery to control lots of people, but there's a loss, there's a scalability that happens there where you can control more people, but there's a loss of control over the machine itself to some degree. And actually, the conclusion of his book has this sort of interesting quote where this is a quote from a 19th century newspaper that describes this sort of conflict between all of these different elements working to control, you know, any given person. So the issue is not that, again, that it's one big brother, but it's multiple different, you know, networks of control that are contrasting each other. So where do we go from there? What I'm proposing that we do is that we look at not just surveillance from a single actor, but that we break the surveillance down in three different ways. The first thing is that we look not just at one surveilling actor, but that we sort of take from Foucault that we look at multiple different actors. So in any given example of surveillance, it's not just Google that's surveilling. Google is surveilling users, but also users are watching Google. Google is watching advertisers. Advertisers are watching the users. The content providers are watching the advertisers. So it's important to understand once the control starts to devolve, how that control is devolving and who has control over that network. The second issue is how thinking beyond direct control of individuals, thinking on this larger level of social discourse, what is the effect not only on only of the harm on one individual, but how does it affect society as a whole? And the last piece is when we're looking at all of the different actors, to think not just about specific acts that are clearly surveillance, where someone's watched and being arrested or being and clearly affected because they're being watched, but think about watching activities more in general and how they interact with one another. And what this, where this gets us to is it gets us to something that I call the Google brain. And what the Google brain is the Google brain is the sort of close integration of Google with the sort of everyday activities and thoughts of its users, and the integration of and the nature of that interaction as a sort of real-time instant loop of feedback. So what I mean by that is Google, when I search on Google, searching on Google is fundamentally different from searching in something like a card catalog, right? Because I do a search and I get the results back immediately. And then I refine it, I do another search, I get the results back very quickly. And then I refine it again, I get more results back. It's quick enough that it's integrated into my line of thought, and it's not separate activity that I have to put a lot of thought into. More importantly, it's the feedback from the activities that I do are integrated back into Google. So when I search on Google, Google is watching me, right? And it's changing the results that I get back depending on what I do. And so it's not just that I'm sort of using a card catalog that's sitting there, or I'm using it very quickly, it's that the card catalog is actually changing as I'm using it, depending on what I'm doing, and Google and I are both depending on one another. So what we end up with is we have this Google brain, and the Google brain is responsible for determining what kinds of content we see online. It's responsible through the search engine, but it's also responsible for this ad engine. The ad engine is responsible for assigning meaning to individual pieces of content. So if I have a New York Times story, and that New York Times story has to be supported by some ad, So one aspect of AdWords that I'll describe briefly shortly is that AdWords are, as we know, very short and simple. Traditionally, a lot of work has been done by ads to create meaning for objects, for consumer objects. So if I have a perfume, then an ad associates the notion of being beautiful with the perfume. when the problem with AdWords ads is they're very short and they don't actually associate any meaning. So one thing that that Google is having to do is it's having to, AdWords system is moving the work of associating the notion of beautiful from the ad onto the content itself, which is directly associated with that. And this is done through a set of mechanized systems that I'll describe that are very difficult to understand. So what we end up with is we end up mechanizing a system that we don't understand very well that's responsible at pretty deep levels for creating meaning in our sort of online media sphere in this sort of integrated Google brain that we're using. So I'm going to walk very briefly through what AdWords does and how it works. So the basic idea is I search for smart travel on Google, and it returns an ad for smartertravel.com. It does that because smartertravel.com bid on the word smart travel. So smart travel offers to pay 25 cents every time someone clicks on smarttravel.com. That's the highest bid. Google shows it along with searches, and every time I click on it, then Google gets the advertiser pays Google 25 cents. There's a separate part of the AdWords system called AdSense, which is responsible for serving AdWords ads on non-search sites. So what AdSense does is it takes a page of content, turns it into a set of terms, and then does that same magic. So this is a set of ads that appeared on CNN.com. Google did its magic and determined that CNN.com is relevant to smart travel. Smarter travel, it's also relevant to dieting and airlines. Smarter travel had won that bid, so every time now someone clicks on smartertravel.com, Google, the advertiser actually pays CNN.com 25 cents or whatever they bid, and Google keeps about 20% of that. So a guy named, one of the questions we have is Google is responsible for doing this sort of meaning association. So within the AdWords system, Google is saying that, you know, smart travel means, in some sense, smartertravel.com. They're associating a term with some sort of ad, some sort of link, someplace to go. The question is, again, how is that different from a card catalog? The danger is that of Google for itself is that it just gets lost in the small details. So again, in Bruno Latour, he's a famous thinker in science and technology studies, has asked this sort of question: What do digital technologies do for us other than just provide lots of small details? How do we combine those together to do something interesting? The answer is the sort of Web 2.0 answer, which is once you get fast enough and once you get enough collectivity built in, then you get then you start to build sort of social connections to it, and you start to have these interesting feedback loops where data is filtering through the technology and through the people to build better and better results. So his example is a traffic jam. Let's say we have lots of different cameras, digital cameras around the city that are providing pictures of traffic. What's the point of that? It's lots of pictures of traffic. The answer is once we get good enough at it, and once you actually have users seeing in their cars pictures of what the current traffic is and responding to it, then it becomes a sort of feedback system that's responding to itself. And so people are going to different places, and you get emergent behavior that didn't exist before the system. So I'm going to talk about six components of the AdWords system. In thinking about the AdWords system, it's important to think about the components and how they work together as a network, and then also how each of those components works as a sort of network of users. The first set of components are the ranking systems. So Google has a set of systems that rank the search results that it returns on its search engine, and then a separate set of systems that rank the ad results that return on the side. So the search results are ranked partially by this PageRank system that's very well known that ranks according to the votes, to how many links a given website has coming into it. So PageRank goes and looks at all the links on it, all the different sites on the web, and counts each link on each site as a vote for interest in another site. So essentially the content producers are voting for what's interesting on the web. But it also uses, they say, 200 other signals to determine what's interesting, what gets ranked up here. I'm just going to, within that search ranking system, there are a number of different watching activities that are happening, some of which look like surveillance and some of which look like not so much surveillance. So the first thing that's happening is that Google are watching these content producers. They're going out and spidering all this content and examining it. The first question is whether that looks like surveillance. That looks actually pretty much like surveillance. Google actually has a lot of control over these websites. Whether or not you rank highly on Google determines largely the success of your website. Google is pretty much the only player out there, so you don't have much choice about whether you're going to let Google rank you if you want to be popular on the web. And Google has the ability to combine the data it collects in this PageRank indexing with a lot of other data to get even more information. So you combine all these things and it looks a lot like surveillance. How does Google exercise that control? Google has a number of different ways to exercise control. They do the PageRank, which is sort of devolving control out to the content producers. They have a set of filters. So a lot of the work we do at the Berkman Center is looking at how Google, among others, filters different websites. So if you search for, Maradona in Argentina, Google might remove some of those results. And then they have some guidelines that they tell webmasters that they have to follow. So here are some guidelines. And that's this sort of example of direct control, like the factory boss on the floor saying you have to do these things or we won't treat you well. The most powerful of those is probably the model control, right? Even though I might remove 10 results about Tiananmen Square or about specific important topics for the purposes of filtering, the filtering has to be sort of manual and it has to be very focused, whereas small changes to the model have a large effect over all of the examples of results. The model of PageRank just provides an engine for the content producers to be watching themselves, which is another example of sort of watching activity within that search ranking. A really good example of the sort of contest that happens between Google and content producers for control over what's appearing is something called Google bombing, which is the practice of manipulating links to articles to make certain results appear on Google. So there was a Google bomb. A bunch of people linked to George Bush with the term miserable failure. And for a long time, Google returned George Bush as an example of miserable failure. Google ended up tweaking its algorithm so that this doesn't work anymore. But some examples of Google bombing still work to some example. So in the 2008 election, it's not showing very well in the video, but down there, when you search for John McCain, down there you see John McCain versus John McCain in the corner. It's not clear if it was necessarily caused by the Google bomb, but there were a lot of bloggers who orchestrated a campaign to increase the rank of that video. So there's a sort of battle here that happens between Google and the content producers for control over that. And Google is required to maintain a lot of control with the content producers in order to maintain the viability of its ranking model. So a bunch of bloggers said, we want the John McCain versus John McCain video, which is very critical. So a bunch of liberal bloggers said, we want this to be the first result for John McCain. So when someone searches for John McCain, they get this highly critical video of him. So a bunch of bloggers posted links to that article with the text John McCain. So Google sees those as votes for the importance of John McCain.
With YouTube videos, another factor is how many people watch them. And of course, posting all those links probably meant that lots of people watched the video too.
So without getting into too much detail about the Google bombing stuff, which is nonetheless interesting, and I'm happy to devolve however you want. Yes, I mean, that. This is sort of one of the interesting cases. It's not actually clear what's gaming and what's true. It could be that lots of bloggers published that link, and then lots of people watched the video, right? And so it became legitimately popular. There's a very interesting difference in the two different ways that this happened. It's very easy to do manipulation of a specific rare term, like miserable failure. There are not a whole lot of web pages that link to miserable failure. So it's pretty easy to do that, and it's pretty easy to pick out that from the noise. It's harder in some senses to do this, because there's lots of pages that link to John McCain, so it's harder to influence the rankings. But it's also harder to pick it out of the noise when it happens, because it looks in some ways like legitimate.
John McCain was actually a heavy user of Google AdWords himself, so like I know I did some anti-McCain Palin pages on my website, and McCain either maybe even purposely or accidentally bought, was just buying AdWords space on any website that was talked about him at all. So like,
yeah, and I'll talk a little bit about the ad ranking.
And what's the connection between the Google bombing and the privacy or surveillance over internet users?
So the connection, which I feel like I'm not doing a great job so far, the connection is that this is one example of the kind of data. So there's a surveillance activity here going on, right? Surveillance is, Google is watching these content producers. I'm arguing that this is a sort of clear example of surveillance, which is that Google is collecting this data. It's doing it without meaningful consent from the content producers, because you have to let Google watch or you don't have any traffic. And it's combining that with lots of other contexts to exert that control. The search ranking is an integral part of the ad ranking, because the ads don't exist without the search engine. And the search engine also is what was responsible for driving the traffic to these websites, so that they can generate advertising revenue. Make sense?
Whether this is explicit or implicit, in other words, does someone start a campaign that they sort of let other people know about?
Yes.
Through
so there's
social
a blog
media,
post.
And then people join it.
So I say, I want this. All bloggers out there, pay attention to me. I want
right.
this link to
so
appear.
So Google
at
could
the top
see that as well. I mean, if they wanted.
Yes,
to.
Yes, but Google. So this is an excellent point. The power of this engine, the way that Google can index all of these pages and have the results look interesting, is it has to devolve power to these content producers. It has to let the website owners vote on what's important, right? Okay? So Google could go in and start manually editing this stuff, but to the degree they manually edit stuff to fix it, they're reducing the collective power, right? So they're inserting their own judgment, mm-hmm. which if you sort of go back to 1992 when Yahoo was the biggest directory of the internet, Yahoo was paying people to go through and say which sites are interesting. That doesn't work, right? There's too many sites, and humans aren't very good at that. So there's a tension there. Google can exert some control. It generally exerts some control through these guidelines. It can exert some control by filtering. But most of the control it exerts is through this model that it sort of lets loose, and it relies on the community watching themselves rather than on Google doing the vast majority of the watching.
Does the model also surveil the searchers, the people who are looking at it, as well as the content itself?
Yes. So Google also does surveil users in this case. They do a couple of different kinds of surveillance. Whenever you click on one of these results in Google, the Google actually has a redirect link there, which is not at all clear. So even if you hover over johnmccain.com, your little status bar says John McCain. When you click on it, it actually goes to google.com/redirect=John McCain. And the whole point of that page is just to track the fact that you've clicked on it. This is a case of sort of maybe surveillance, because the sort of core question is they're watching you, they're doing it without your knowledge. There's some level of consent, even though, again, to be a sort of citizen in the digital world, you have to use Google, essentially, so there's not a whole lot of consent there. And they certainly don't ask you if they can do it in the first place. But there's not a whole lot of control, right? I mean, they're not doing anything to you. So it's in some ways looks like surveillance and some not. What Google does more interestingly there is that Google's PageRank algorithm is described by Google now and widely by everybody uses it as a sort of voting system. So they say content producers vote for other websites to say who's popular or not. But if you read Brin and Pages, who are the two founders of Google, they wrote a paper about PageRank when they're in school because it was originally an academic project. And the way they describe it is as a user simulation. So what they say is PageRank is the chance that a random user randomly clicking on links will end up on a given web page, right? So it's not voting per se. What they're actually trying to do is they're actually trying to simulate a user. They're trying to figure out what a user would do. This is reflected as well in their current language, where they talk about extensively about returning what users mean rather than what users say. And my presentation has just died here out of order. This is not good. Also just lost a lot of them. That's okay. So they talk about what, so we'll just go off the, go on the high wire here. If I search for Chevrolet Magnum on Google, Chevrolet Magnum, Google says, all right, you could look at Chevrolet Magnum, but you probably don't actually want what you said. What you probably want is Dodge Magnum, right? The way they've done that is through user surveillance, right? Or by monitoring users. So the way they've done that is they know that the vast majority of users who type in Chevrolet Magnum immediately follow that by typing in Dodge Magnum, right? The interesting thing that's going on here is that the PageRank algorithm is not an algorithm to say anything absolute about what Chevrolet Magnum means. What it is it's a way of trying to determine what users mean when they say Chevrolet Magnum, and what users mean when they say Chevy Magnum is Dodge Magnum, right? The input for that is that the page ranking system and the search results are a system of constant experimentation on users. If you look at there are lots of Google researchers talking about the fact that they're constantly doing real-time experience. They're constantly changing the Google engine and seeing if they do small tweaks in the model, does it mean that users tend to click lower down on the list, which means there's some lower search result that's more valuable, or are they immediately following it up with other terms? And the only sense in which they know that their engine is working is by doing those constant user experiments and tracking the logging that they're doing of the users. So when we're thinking about control over the search ranking, again, Google has some control through the model. The content producers have some control by having these links, which are kind of votes, and the users collectively as a group have a great deal of control by observing the user simulation every time that they use the system. Every time you use the system, you're both observing this user simulation that PageRank is doing, and you're being observed by that user simulation. So when I just ran this Chevrolet, there was a simulated user who just said over my shoulder, oh, you didn't really mean Chevrolet Magnum, you meant Dodge Magnum. And there's another very interesting one, which is if I search for Yahoo Jail, right, given the context of our previous use of Yahoo Mail by China, it says you probably meant Yahoo Mail, not Yahoo Jail, right? Ad rank. I'm just going to talk about the ad ranking system, and then I'm going to give up. So the ad ranking system, interestingly, has the ads have ranking as well. And there are three ways that the ads get ranked in the AdWords system. When you have that list over on the side of that page, it gets listed first by bid price. So if you bid a higher price, your ad's generally going to be higher up in the list. So you can bid a lot of money and you can get your ad shown. But that's not the only way. There are also extensive detailed guidelines and policies that they have to determine the quality of your ads and the quality of your landing pages. And in some amorphous way, those affect what they call your quality score. So if they determine that you have a good ad and a good landing page, your ad goes up in that list and you don't have to bid as much to get a highly bid item. They also pay attention to clicks. So ads that get a bunch of clicks tend to go up in the list. So if you have an ad that gets a lot of clicks, you don't have to pay as much to have it go up to the top. All of these are sort of mechanisms of control through surveillance. So in the first case, there's an ad auction, which basically consists of advertisers watching other advertisers through a market. So instead of Google having to set prices for these individual words that it's bidding on, Google just sets up this auctioning machine that just runs and lets the advertisers bid against another, and that determines, that monitors the value of all these terms automatically without Google having to do it. The guidelines and policies are an example of sort of typical top-down surveillance. So this is a good example of something that clearly looks like surveillance, where Google is has a list of, an extensive list of guidelines that it requires that that all advertisers follow. And then it has an even more extensive list of rules, right? So a lot of these rules are due to the fact that there are a lot of laws about advertising. Advertising is a lot more heavily regulated than content. So you can't, for instance, advertise prostitution, right? There are laws against that. So Google has to have a rule, and they have to try to stop that. With all of these, though, it's never exactly clear how much of this is enforced by Google and how much of it is just supposed to be enforced by the users. The language that Google always uses is, if you follow our guidelines, you're going to have better ads, and more users will go to your links, and you won't have to pay as much for your ads. But they do actually enforce a lot of this stuff as well. This is a sort of classic, you know, Foucauldian twist where they're saying, don't do it because we're telling you to do it because we're the boss. You should really be doing it because you think it's a good idea and because you should enforce it on yourself. And furthermore, we're not going to actually be clear how we're going to enforce that. So it's not clear when you have to do what we say and when you don't have to do what we say because we're not telling you.
I love the rule that says don't break the rule.
Yes. So I mean, there's sort of three sorts of rules here. There's lots of clear sort of rules about illegality, and then the other big sorts of rules are rules about following Google's own guidelines, right? So that I'm summarizing all these. That particular rule is don't advertise sites that promote breaking Google's webmaster guidelines, right?
So, but it says don't break these rules.
Yeah.
This is my language, right?
Oh, that's your language.
There's probably 20 page. If you can go to Google and you can look up 20 pages of description of all of these. So these are my, you know, each of these is a paragraph on text of Google of what you have, what you do, and what you have to do, and what you don't have to do. Completely off the reservation, but I'm just going to keep going for a few more minutes. Interrupt me as you have questions. One of the big problems with advertising in general is that it's advertisers have generally been very, very poor at determining how effective their ads are. So there are some very interesting studies that show that advertising budgets are generally determined as a percentage of last year's sales. Right? This makes absolutely no sense. The whole point of advertising is that you should drive sales from advertising. So you should determine how much the advertising increases your sales and base it on that. Just because you have lots more sales, you shouldn't have more advertising. You should have more sales because you have more advertising. There's a case in which Anheuser-Busch in the 1960s allowed some marketing researchers to control the level of advertising in a collection of small markets. So that they could sort of decrease some advertising by 50%, increase some advertising by 50%. What they found is that in many cases, decreasing advertising increased sales, right? but this is not at all clear. Companies generally don't have a good sense of this. The best metric that's used in sort of mainstream advertising is recall. So they'll do a survey a week later and say, what do you remember about any beer commercials that you've seen? And 37% of people will remember the commercial, but that doesn't really say anything about how many beers you've bought. The interesting thing about AdWords is it lets you track that. So one of the kinds of tracking that AdWords does is it tracks conversion. So it tracks not only when you click on a link, every time you click on a link, Google knows that. It also lets the advertisers put what they call a conversion cookie on a given page in a site. So if you click on a link at to go to Amazon, then that registers at Google and Amazon can find that out. But Amazon can also put a cookie on its purchase page so that if you click on the link and you actually make it all the way through the purchase, then Amazon registered that. This is sort of a key piece of information that's never really existed before. Amazon can precisely track for any given ad that it's running how many of those ads result in purchases. What this means is we have, all of a sudden, one of these interesting feedback loops, right? We have we have an advertiser able to put up an ad. It's able to track that ad. It's able to see out of 5 ads which ones perform the best. It can, you know, the same day change the ad so that it has 5 more ads that look a lot like the one that worked best, and then it can optimize for that ad. And you end up having this conversation between the users who's doing watching by clicking on these ads, right, and reading the advertisers, and the advertiser who's watching the user by taking in all of these statistics. One of the key characteristics of how this works is it works as a scaled machine. So one of Google's guiding policies in designing all this stuff is it wants machines to do stuff instead of people because that scales, right? So advertising has a long history of being run by advertising agencies, right? There's someone who sits in between the content providers and the advertisers, and it helps write the copy. It helps determine what are the good places to advertise, what are your best markets. It helps determine how effective your ads are. Google is essentially trying to replace all that with a machine. It has a machine that determines the value of things, so you don't need a broker to go contact newspapers. The machine does that. It has a machine that determines how well your ads are doing. You couldn't even tell that with your people before. They were just telling you recall percentages, and now you know that exactly. It has a machine that's putting this content in front of people through the search results. So this sort of PageRank machine, which is based on these sort of the sort of surveillance of users and the interest of users and content producers, is determining which pages are interesting and which are not, and which are generating the traffic that can see all of this, that can host ads. The danger of that is that all of these are sort of complex machines that rely on these sort of iterative feedback mechanisms where I see a page, I do a search, I do a search on Google, I see the results, I click on maybe the third item. When I click on the third item, Google thinks, oh, maybe that should be the second item. So the next person who searches it gets different results, and refines those results, and you end up with these complicated feedback mechanisms that are happening all the time and that nobody really understands very well how they're happening. You have the same thing happening in this advertising system where nobody really understands really well why a given word is priced at a given level. It's all sort of black magic. You have the same sort of thing that's happening on, you know, click-throughs. There's a sort of, you know, magic of generating these click-throughs. And furthermore, Google has this complex combination of these click-throughs and the bid price and these guidelines to determine where the ads get ranked. And it's not clear how that emerges into what, who gets to advertise on that top spot. On top of that, see if I can find it in my screwed up ads. On top of that, one of the defining characteristics and something enforced by these guidelines, I'll just show it here, is length. There are a couple things. AdWords have to be short, obviously. There's not much space. And they have to be relevant, which is very interesting, right? Google has extensive rules that say you have to say what you're advertising. If you say something's on sale, you have to have it on sale. But you have to be specific about what you're advertising. When you go to a page, it has to provide that object. Okay, and the ad also has to be precisely relevant to the keyword. So what this means is this sort of whole industry of advertising, what historically have been called jingles, right? You have sort of all these ads that have nothing to do with what you're actually advertising. They tell jokes. They sort of make you think that you're going to be beautiful if you use a given perfume. There's not room for any of that, right? Because they're not allowed by the guidelines. You don't have the space to do that work, to assign. You don't have the space within an AdWords ad to make you think that a perfume is going to make you beautiful. Okay? You don't. So instead, who has to do that work, the danger is that who has to do that work is the content itself. This danger is magnified by the fact that the ad is associated directly with the content. Right? So instead of having an ad that's sitting in the New York Times as a whole, and that just has to be sold by the quality of the New York Times, a given content has to, for a content producer to survive, to generate revenue, they have to have specific pieces of content generating revenue off of specific ads. And those ads can't do any hard work to generate interest, to tell you that that using a given perfume is going to make you beautiful. So there's a big danger that all of a sudden the content itself has to do a lot of that work, right? The content itself has to be about perfumes, and ideally the content that's going to be the best, that's going to generate the most click-throughs and the most conversions into buyers, is content that's going to make you think that the perfume is going to make you beautiful. And if you look at these sort of examples of ads, of sort of print ads where you have, you know, a model and it has a little picture of a perfume and it says beautiful underneath, and you compare that with your list of AdWords ads for perfume, you see all these guys are being very good. They're, you know, self-enforcing. They're, you know, the surveillance that Google is putting on through these guidelines, it's all about free shipping, right? Perfume free shipping. You even have a coupon code to use there.
So at the risk of derailing, let me ask sort of the big question, which is, here's a talk that starts with an invocation of Big Brother and the NSA and ends up with a subtle point about the semiotics of perfume ads. Are you not blurring very, very big distinctions on the nature of watching by using the term surveillance for all of them?
Yes,
you're using surveillance to mean watching that includes control. Probably not a bad definition. But then it gets really slippery, because essentially what you're saying is that if you are doing anything online, Google is in control. Are there cases where Google is watching you that is not surveillance?
The point is that there are some cases in which what Google is doing looks like surveillance. And interestingly, those cases are the control of the big institutions. So in the cases where Google is controlling content producers, they have this, right? Content producers have to do that, and they're encouraged to do it themselves in sort of classic Google ways. So this looks a lot like surveillance. Same things with the content producers and the advertisers. The content producers also have a less extensive but also a list of guidelines. But the work, the power of the engine, right, the power that it's getting to sort of affect society is happening through some other watching activities that don't actually look, that look like surveillance in some ways, but don't look like surveillance in other ways. And some things that don't look like surveillance at all. So when you have Google watching the users, it looks like surveillance in some ways because you don't have consent, right, and it's combining all this data with other data they're having. But there's no clear line of control there, right? But to understand...
fast and loose term to refer to when I'm searching for Chevy Caravan and then Google says, did you mean Dodge Caravan?
That, right? I'm saying that's not surveillance. That's my point. That's not surveillance. But to understand, to associate the impacts of Google's system of watching all of this traffic, what we have to do is we have to include not only the things that look like surveillance, but we have to include within that network the things that don't so much look like surveillance, but have an impact on what the surveillance causes.
I think what I'm looking for, and then I'll shut up because obviously there's a lot of other hands up, is part of what's so exciting about a digital world is this idea that we can have these feedback loops, right? And the idea that we can listen to a customer, or we can listen to a reader, or so on and so forth. And we built them all over the place. We build them with comments on blogs. We build them by having traffic statistics. It's like the difference between having a map of highways and suddenly a map that shows you where the traffic is, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in the past, we just saw very rough infrastructure. Now we actually see the flow on top of it. I would argue that this can also be a good thing. My worry about using the term surveillance is that any act of watching turns into something sinister. And I guess what I'm looking for from you, and maybe this is or isn't fair, but I'm going to ask for it anyway, is a clear distinction between good watching and surveillance watching.
I don't see surveillance as good or bad. What I see it as is it's a matter of controlling or not controlling. There are lots of people who think that we should surveil more, right? It's not whether it's good or bad. And the big point I'm trying to make, I'm agreeing, to understand what's going on, we have to understand that Google does have this sort of traditional type surveillance of these big institutions. But the reason it's important to include these other kinds of watching activities is precisely what you're saying. It's because what's controlling the overall network of what's happening is not just Google doing this sort of thing that looks bad because it's surveillance. It's also the users are doing watching things, and they're exerting control over this network, even though we don't call those things surveillance and we shouldn't. It's still, to understand what's going on with this larger level of surveillance, we have to understand that, for instance, it's content producers and users and advertisers who are watching and largely driving the engine, whereas it's Google who's mostly just devising the machine. to accept these inputs.
Are there cases where law enforcement has gotten an IP address to find out what somebody's been doing and then has subpoenaed Google search records to find out what they were searching for? I think the Kaylee Anthony thing, they got some records of her searching for bad stuff, which I assume was just in the search history on her laptop. But, you know, the same data for a while anyway presumably exists at Google, and I just wondered if law enforcement
I don't have the affirmative answer to that, but in general practice it's very well accepted practice to go and do specific searches. Google has I would be very surprised if that has not happened.
Yeah,
but it's easier to sort of to get, if you have a specific instance of a specific user, you can get a warrant and you can do a lot, right? What the government has done that Google has refused is said, Google said after 9/11, give us your search logs. We want to find out who the bad guys are, right?
Right.
And Google is one of the people who've.
There have been cases where warrants have been served on Google and they've turned over information about specific.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Well, I mean, because that would be, that would explain why this distinction has to be fuzzy. As long as the data is there, it can ex post facto seem to be a form of surveillance.
But I still think there's a...
with that, Harry, is that then any watching looks like surveillance, well, right? I mean, essentially, if we say, I watch my users, right? I'm at Global Voices, and I watch my users, and I look to see what content they read, because I'd like to know what content I should be spending money to produce.
Right.
Generally speaking, we would not say that that's surveillance.
That's
although
right.
there is a control aspect to
that's
it.
Right. That's right.
If people really like the fast breaking news from Mumbai, we did. We're going to emphasize the next time that there's a fast breaking story like the coup in Guinea today. Maybe we're going to do more coverage on it. Certainly, if the possibility is that I keep my logs and therefore they could get subpoenaed at a later date, then am I surveilling all the time? If the definition gets that broad, is the useful
term,
word?
The term doesn't serve us well. That's right, but this is it's because this
my
technology
only point is
has made it fuzzy.
Serve us well.
Yeah,
I sort of have the same issue with surveillance, and I want to go back to the beginning of your presentation when you were giving an example of a welfare person. Mm-hmm. The welfare person does not get checked if he got married or got a job. What he gets checked for, if he actually is lying, the basis for getting that welfare check is a lie or is it true?
No, I mean, well, the welfare law is unmarried women without jobs.
Correct.
Get,
so
what
he's being surveyed for is if he's lying that he's still not married and that he still doesn't have a job. Nobody surveys him if he actually got a job. What we only care about if he's actually getting his check on the basis of him lying about it or not.
No, the surveillance, the welfare agencies, so there's this whole, you know, the 1990s, these data matching systems were created, right? Where the government has the ability to look at, for instance, your tax returns.
Correct, but they're only looking for if the person lied on his application.
That's
if the person goes into the welfare office and says, I'm married or I have a job, then he would not. There would be nothing to catch him on.
No,
right?
If I get a job and I'm making $100,000 a year, I'm not going to get welfare anymore.
Correct, but if you make getting a job and you're only making $2 a year and
right. So the question is that people, there's a limit there, right? It's the
correct.
It's
but what we test, what we survey in the person for is he lying to us to get the check or not? We're not really surveillancing him on the fact if he's married. We don't care if he is, as long as he's not lying to us.
Okay.
And therefore, he's getting his check on the basis of a lie. And I think there is the same distinction in what you're talking about. It's not, if Google is collecting information about us as a society and as a group, as long as it's not pertinent to a particular individual, it cannot be isolated to an individual, that's not a harmful data. It's when it's becoming isolated and could be used against a specific individual.
My argument, though, is that that's the point, is that even if it doesn't do that, if it affects the kind of content that we get online, right? If this changes, if we get more stories about digital cameras because digital camera ads pay well, then that affects us as a society, right? Even if it's completely aggregated.
As he said, if he gets more traffic because the news are coming out faster than anywhere else, being it about Mumbai or anywhere else, and then he changes it, then it's all healthy for society.
I'm not saying it's all bad. I'm not. All I'm doing is posing a question. I have no idea what it is. So let me sort of.
It's a really heavily loaded term, Hal. I mean, if we took 2/3 of this talk and talked about it as feedback, rather than as surveillance, right?
I think
it would have a really different valence.
But I keep on saying this. My point is that the only time I use the word surveillance is in these sort of clear examples of where Google is controlling people directly with the data. For examples like users watching other users and content producers watching other content producers, those are watching activities that are seeded by surveillance, but the point is that there are lots of watching activities that are not surveillance that are interacting through these feedback loops with the larger impact of the original surveillance activity. So to understand why it matters that Google's collecting all of this data and whether that amounts to surveillance, we have to not just look at the list of guidelines, right, and say, does that matter? How are they controlling content producers? We have to look at how it's seeding only these other watching activities, which are not themselves surveillance, and what an impact the overall system has, which might be good or might be bad. And my larger point is amazingly complex. It's such a complex system of network feedbacks that we just don't know how the heck it works. We know what the 20th century version got us, right? The reason this matters is that what we know is that when there was genocide going in Rwanda, we got this, right? Instead of this, right? It matters. That's why it matters in the end. We don't know what the new version is going to get us. We don't know. It might be better. Maybe we'll pay more attention to genocide, but maybe we'll pay more attention to digital cameras, right? There are more blogs, but there are less newspapers. And I think that if there's a takeaway from this, on a policy point of view, the takeaway is that we need to think a lot more about the space between the supply and demand and the mechanisms that are creating that space in this advertising industry, and less specifically about whether it's a supply or a demand problem of people demanding news or supplying it on specific topics. Yes?
So to build on this a little bit from the social theory dimension, because surveillance is Foucault's term, right? And he uses it for a whole host of social phenomena that include things even just to the super seemingly benign level of reading books, right? And the dissemination of a professional form of knowledge in about a realm of society like psychiatry, right? And it's that he's in dialogue with a whole tradition of thinkers who are interested in the social phenomena where people have society, and that's sort of imagined as this autonomous set of relations. And then on top of that, there's something else, whether it's a technology, whether it's another set of relations like capitalism. And the theorists are concerned about it when the actors, the human beings with their ethics and our sense of their integrity, are being subjected to a system that they don't understand fully. And that produces negative outcomes, or benign to negative outcomes, such as alienation, right? And so something that, in a formal sense, might just be, oh, why do we care that, you know, this labor is taken care of in another country? Well, maybe we care if it means that now our clothes that we wear every day are being made in a way that we don't ethically assent to, right? So I think the introduction, it helps a little bit to unpack surveillance like that, because it gives us the context. In your website case, for example, it's not a big deal to vilify, like, oh, I'm collecting user information about my users and this is somehow problematic. But it might cause us to question and cause us to raise red flags if it's like, well, we've all kind of agreed to hand over bits of information about ourselves, or we know today that Mumbai is actually really important because we kind of know the Google brain or the whatever the Ethan brain is dealing with it, but we're not quite sure what the terms of that are. And so it's just an issue then of assent on the one hand and technical control on the other hand. How do we act within this system in a way that reflects our intentions as our actual outcomes? So I guess what's at stake from an individual's point of view in understanding this system better, which I think you've done a great job in the theoretical of laying out for it, is how do you use it on the one hand to be rebellious, on the other hand to be creative, or very broadly speaking, to make the world a better place, right? And that's a very interesting situation for Google, one, because it is such a market leader, and two, because Google does have as its mission statement, do no evil. And it does have huge philanthropic endeavors, and it's funding part of the Berkman Center, I imagine, and all of these things. So it's how do you engage with something that is a fascinating and extensive social phenomenon, understand it better, and then allow all these other things that we want to emerge from that.
Yeah, and that's my hope is that by pointing out that there are users who are doing their own watching activities that have their own impacts on the network, we can start to understand how the users can participate, or content producers or advertisers, how different people have their own sort of levers of control into this larger system that's not just Google Big Brother watching you.
Between three groups, there's the content providers who are hoping to get their content out and also may get some advertising revenue, and the advertisers, the users, all of whom have their own agendas. And of course, sometimes one thing about the ads though is that they vary them a lot according to like who's looking at them, where you're coming from. So like most probably most of the Google ads, for example, are probably geographic targeted, because I know like I sometimes buy ads and I don't want.
They do.
I'm pretty much only interested in the United States and Canada, maybe Western Europe, so I don't want somebody in India or Nigeria setting up a click fraud farm.
AdWords ads are only geographically targeted. Yeah. That's the only, or at least, again, the AdWords text ads. Everything else is determined by this ranking. They do have a notion of geographical location, which is just based on your.
But even that varies somewhat. Like somebody looking at my website might see from New Hampshire, another battleground state, might have seen the John McCain ads with content about Joe the Plumber and all that, whereas somebody in Massachusetts might not have seen those.
Yes, like you can. I mean, and you can look at this stuff yourself. You can set up an AdWords account and look at the control panel. One of the panels is sort of the locations, and that's another rule, is you have to, if you advertise locally, you have to advertise it in your location, and you can't advertise for Memphis Pizza in Boston. That's breaking the rule. Who knows if Google is enforcing that, or if you're supposed to enforce it yourself.
You can even target particular sites, too, of course. Too.
Yes.
I just wanted to raise something in response to what Roxy was saying, which is the idea that you sort of should be able, using these very complicated systems, to produce outcomes that reflect your intent. So that actually, I think, I used to work at Google on AdWords, actually. Part of the idea behind the black boxing and the opacity of the mechanism is that they actually want to make sure that people are being honest about it. Like, they're sending honest signals. I won't say it always works. So Google bombing is one example of how if you understand how a system works, you can manipulate it to the point where you affect where something shows up in the rankings. And by the same token, I think part of the idea behind making what counts as landing page quality or ad quality a little opaque is that they want to make it harder for people to game the system if they want to game it. I'm just putting it out there because I also feel ambivalent about opacity versus transparency.
And again, this is the point, is that it's a balance between lots of different kinds of surveillance. So this is another kind of surveillance, people trying to watch Google to understand how these things work, and Google is resisting that because Google wants to have a sense that it's reflecting the truth, right? I mean, that Google works best if you think, I'm getting New York Times from Google because New York Times means nytimes.com, not because there's this incredibly complicated machine that's sort of churning, and says, okay, this is what it means because we've made all these hard decisions. So there's definitely that element. So you had a question, I think we're out of time.
Well, I'm a lawyer, so my question actually, or my comment to what you've said will be related to these binding rules of law. So first of all, I can't really see law being concerned about Big Brother, watching big companies, except for maybe unfair commercial practices, but it's not really surveillance then. When surveillance is at stake, it's more about issues about privacy or data protection. And then in the European Union, we have this very demanding system of data protection, right? Personal data protection only in commercial relations. But this is pretty much what you've been talking about. So there are limitations on the scope of processing the data. There are limitations of on who you can, whom you can make the data available, and so on. And I haven't heard. And plus, there are authorities which are to supervise whether the processing is going on as I've described. And I haven't heard in any of the 27 jurisdictions, actually, that there have been any problems with Google specifically, which means that probably also according to these demanding standards and very much appreciated by the people like Daniel Solov, right, there is any problem here. And then there is my question, which refers to all this. What is the normative dimension, normative conclusion of what you've been talking about? Do you suggest stricter policies of Google or stricter policies of transferring this data to the guys which are authorized to use coercion against us, which is government, or what is the conclusion in this field?
I'm not a lawyer or a policy person. Okay. I think it's mostly important to tell this story. So again, what I'm trying to do is pose a question. And the question is, what is the effect of this sort of machine on our system of media creation? I think law in this case can actually be a problem because, you get into these questions of what harm is it doing to some individual? And I think that's actually a very interesting framing, and that's sort of one thing I'm trying to argue against, is that we shouldn't think of something as surveillance if it doesn't do a specific harm to a specific individual. There are certainly semantic issues. Maybe we could come up with some other term to call it, but I think it's important to look at these examples where things that look a lot like surveillance, massive collections of personal data, have very important effects on society. So that's sort of one thing is sort of building out from that and looking at beyond just these sort of specific legal questions. This is the sort of issue with the Warren and Brandeis mm-hmm. article that I started with, which is they have this very interesting paragraph about sort of the sort of publicization of gossip, but then they're judges, right? They're lawyers, so they descend into these sort of specific rights for a given individual. As far as there are sort of policy implications, you know, there are arguments about whether or not there are certainly people proposing that there should be some regulation of search engines and advertising markets because they occupy the central role and Google shouldn't have this sort of, Google has this incredibly ability to determine what, you know, things.
Okay, but then to reframe my question, do you think that the policy of Google should be kind of tweaked in any respect? Should it be kind of reshaped or should it be as it is now? Because you know much more about the policies and the way it works than me, for instance.
Yes. I think, as its own actor, I think that Google does a lot of good in a lot of cases of relying very well on this model. Google understands that its strength comes from the sort of collective input that it gains to its model. So it's actually very laudable that Google didn't fix Google bombing, that miserable failure. Google bomb lived on Google for, like, I don't know, 2 years or something. It lived a long time, and anybody could have gone and fixed it, and they refused to until some engineer figured out how to fix it in this sort of generic way. I think the biggest way that they fail, if they fail at all, is in these issues of transparency. I think they try to play these games of saying, you should do these things because they're good for you. And we're not exactly clear about whether we're going to make them do which of these things we're making you do and which of these things you just have the choice to do whether or not you want to do them and how that's going to affect. Now, there are legitimate issues with gaming the system. They obviously have huge problems there. There's this whole other issue of click fraud that they have to deal with in the same sense that they have to sort of prevent gaming there. But if there's a sort of easy area for sort of Google to reassess what it's doing, I think it's sort of looking really hard at that sort of area of openness.
If you look at this in a sort of a larger context in terms of how the technology that's evolving and stuff like Google, which is using, in effect, a large rule set to evaluate a set of data and give a set of results, and in their case, not take an action, like you're saying surveillance entails. So you take a large set of data, and it's the action that's taken that sort of implies surveillance, right? Jail, taken away in the middle of the night, whatever. These large machines that I'm assuming are going to be more and more prevalent in everyday use and everyday sort of technology that are based on rules and not necessarily surveillance in the historic sense of when you look at SS or I can't remember the one in, well, a bunch of them that pretty much did quite, you know, KGB or, like we were saying, any of the ones that you have conspiracy theory on, where you have prejudice and morality and all these weird sort of blurry lines that are involved. Like, is it really then surveillance? What is the harm or danger of surveillance? Where you have surveillance that's done by an entity that has a, as you're saying, a transparent rule set, or a rule set that is in fact understandable. Is it then really surveillance, or is it, as these machines grow along, just gathering data that can be used to provide us, or the users of whatever the equipment is, with a more meaningful result?
The issue,
no action ever taken.
For me, the issue with surveillance is not an issue of whether it's good or bad. You know, that depends on who's doing the surveilling. Is it you or someone else, right? So if it's us surveilling the Soviet Union, then it seems like a good thing, right? So it's not an issue of whether it's good or bad. It's an issue of a concentration of control, right? So to the degree that Google is exercising manual control over these things by designing the model, by issuing guidelines, by issuing rules, by filtering stuff, then that's concerning simply because it's always, there's a concern, or at least a value in knowing where the power lies, right? So Google might be good today, but who knows, right?
Technically, the power lies in the rule set.
So number one, Google designs the rule set, so there's power in Google. But Google is also devolving power into this network, so this is sort of, you know, Foucault notion of devolving, giving the power to the factory floor workers, right? But Google's sort of doing that times 10. But there's still a machine there, right? So then, all right, the power is going to these workers, but they still have real power. And if that power is to encourage certain kinds of articles to get posted in the New York Times and not other kinds of articles, or certain kind of ads to rise up the list. So if I want to, you know, publish an ad on, you know, why George Bush is an alien, and I think that's really important, I'm not going to be able to publish that ad on AdWords because nobody's going to click on it, right? So there's a machine there that has power to determine, you know, how I get to impact society. And it's important to understand that machine exists and to start to try to tease out, you know, how it works and what the results are going to be so that, again, we don't make the same mistakes we've been making as long as media has been around. I mean, it's always been the advertising supportive media has always, or government supportive media has always been complicated and troublesome. But it's important to understand that, to understand the effects it's having in society and how we can, to the degree it's good or bad, make it better. Over time.
Should we wrap it up there and encourage people to keep talking with you about it afterwards? Thanks.